Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the City Library for our first session in this very exciting week, which is Local History Week. It's fantastic to see everybody along. I hope you've brought your lunch, so crunching of lunch bags and things is absolutely acceptable. So we've invited you to bring your lunch, so please feel free to eat your lunch. As I say, this is our first lunchtime talk. We've got five talks this week, and we hope that we get the same numbers to each talk. This is absolutely fantastic. I can see lots of familiar faces and a few unfamiliar ones as well, so that's absolutely fantastic. Thank you for coming. The walks that we've got around the city kick off on Wednesday, and they go right through till Sunday. We just have asked people to book for those because we're limiting numbers so we don't lose people around Savage Crescent and various other exciting walks. So please see somebody at the desk if you'd like to book for one of those walks. A lot of the library staff you'll see today have logos emblazoned on their chests. It's to celebrate the launch of Pātaka Iparangi, Manawatū Memory Online. So that's happening on Thursday night. That's the City Library and the City Archives' new digital library. And that's happening at 6 o'clock down in Sound and Vision with special guest Jock Phillips. So do pick up a program, and you should all have an invitation on your chair for the launch on Thursday. So without further ado, we want to launch into our first lunchtime talk. We've got Jill White, who's going to talk about the Manawatū River. And to introduce Jill, I've got Leslie Courtney, our city archivist. So please, enjoy the talk, and we hope to see you throughout the week at other events.
Thank you for coming, everyone. I've got the privilege of introducing Jill to you. Jill White, as you know, probably best of all, is our an ex-mayor of Palmerston North from 1998 to 2001. And Jill is now on the Horizons Regional Council, so she's certainly still in the public eye. What you may not know so much about Jill is that Jill started her MA in 1992. It kind of got put on the sidelines while she was attending to much more, not necessarily more important matters, but a bit more noticeable matters anyway. And when she relinquished her being the Mayor of Palmerston North, she went back to her MA. At that stage, she hadn't quite determined exactly what she was going to do, but because she was so fully involved with the 2004 flood, and she was on the Flood Relief Trust, she was pretty sure that she needed to know more about this river that is part of all our lives. So that was the topic of Jill's thesis for her MA. And today she has severely abridged it, I imagine, Jill, to give us the highlights of her thesis. So welcome to Jill.
Thank you. Yes, I promise you I won't give you 30,000 words today. But congratulations to the City Library and in particular Philippa and Leslie for this very exciting initiative where we start to really have a week of celebrating our wonderful local history. Now, I called my thesis An Uneasy Relationship, the history of Palmerston North City and the Manawatū River from 1941 to 2006. Well, those sort of dates got stretched a little both ways. In fact, it's now up until 2008, last weekend. So, you know, this is, I think, really it's indicative of a river. It flows on, and so does its history. Now, when you're talking about a relationship of a city and a river, you're really talking about the perceptions that people of the city have about the river. And I want to start off by just sharing a few of those perceptions. And I'll talk a bit more about some of them. This is the first one. And this was the sort of frontispiece to my thesis. Machines quarry its gravel. Farms now cover its fertile plains, protected from flooding. That was a wee bit hopeful. While the city of Palmerston North nestles uneasily beside it. And that was where my thesis started. Richard Herdigan, you know, who just knows so much about our Manawatū. Right. The next one, as a consequence of the industriousness of that time, the Manawatū is not today a river that excites the popular imagination. It has become too civilised. With the loss of its native forest went so much of the Manawatū's mystique. I question that word, civilised. And I love this one. It's a superb river, even though it snakes and does its terrible things. But it shows such beauty and such delicacy that I just delight in it. And it won't be a surprise to you to know that those are the words of Jack Register. And I today just had to bring along one of my favourite possessions, this painting, a very unusual one of Jack's, but of the Manawatū River. Come up and have a look at it later. I know the reflections make it a bit difficult to see, but it'll be here for you to look at later on. Right, so that's just a little to sort of start about the river. And it is no accident that my first quote was Richard Heddegan's about nestling uneasily. Because when I was thinking about my thesis, as Leslie said, it was after the 2004 floods, and I for a long time had been very interested in the flood control of the Manawatū River. And that's an interesting word, it's a very engineering word, the control of a river. Rivers don't always quite oblige in the way that one might hope from a control system. You know, I think you're all aware, as I am, that Palmerston North City has developed on the floodplain of the Manawatū River. And I have to say that this book of Ian Matheson's, Council and Community, A History of Palmerston North City Council, 125 years of it, this has got wonderful maps in it showing the early drainage patterns and the early streets. If you want to have a look later, I've marked all the pages with the drainage patterns in it because it just shows absolutely the evidence of the old watercourses and of the swamps, the lagoons, the oxbows, and of course we've still got the evidence of them there today. Some things look hidden, but they're not. And the old watercourses of the Manawatū are still very much there as part of our built-up city. Right. Very different start of the settlement here from that of Whanganui, Waikato and Christchurch. And the reason I mention those three is that they have got very significant rivers. Those cities all started developing on the banks of their rivers. We didn't. We started up on the higher, drier, Papaioia, the clearing, the land where the square is, where we are now. Very good reason for that. The forest and the swamps down nearer the river were not exactly inviting for early settlement, but they were very inviting for the forests. They were very inviting for potential farmland. And by 1941, there were farms, there were orchards, there were market gardens, there were council stables down by the between the square and, or between Ferguson Street really, and the Manawatū River. By that time also, though, with the clearing of the forests by the river, there were 77 acres that had been eroded from around the Fitzroy Bend area, and there was enormous concern about whether the river would erode in at Fitzroy Bend, come into some of the old watercourses, and the first old watercourse that there was real worry about was the Te Nutu Lagoon. And if you think about the contours of Churchill Avenue, that gives you a pretty good picture of where the old Te Nutu Lagoon was. Then what we now call the Awatea Stream wound its way down through Hokafetu to the Hokafetu Lagoon, now called the Centennial Lagoon. And right from the very early days, there was concern about what happens if the river cuts into a depression near Fitzroy Bend, comes through the old Nutu Lagoon down the Awatea Stream into the Hokafetu Lagoon, and cuts sort of Hokafetu effectively in half. And of course, that led to things like river boards being set up, and the river board back in the 1920s tried to cut a little bypass of the river at Fitzroy Bend, did a bit of work with groins, did a bit of work with willow planting. But it was really not to very much avail. And that brings me to 1941. And the reason I chose 1941 for the start of my thesis was it was a year when the country sat up and said, we have to do something. The floods are really wreaking havoc. Now, this, of course, is a European settlement speaking. Before European settlement in Palmerston North, there is a wonderful history of the Manawatū River, a wonderful history of the fortified sites, of the food basket. That's not my story to tell today, but I do want, in mentioning that, to pay my respects to the people of Rangitane and to say that this is their history. And they had a very different approach to the river to the European settlements and this question about controlling the river. So in 1941, Bob Semple brought in a Rivers Control Act, and by the time it came back from the select committee, someone had had the good sense to add soil conservation in. So it became the 1941 Soil Conservation and Rivers Control Act. And the reason I chose that time was that led to the setting up of the catchment boards. And the Manawatū Catchment Board was the first catchment board to be gazetted and the second to actually be up and running. And therein lies lots of stories which I might have time to touch on shortly. 1941 also, of course, was a great flood. And over here, which you also may like to come out and look at later, over there is a map showing the extent of the flood in 1941. Now, the wide striped bits, all these ones here, and of course down here, show the extent of the flooding in 1941. This is Ferguson Street here and Fitzherbert Avenue along here. So the bridge along here. The river curving its way around Hokafetu. Centennial Lagoon, the old Nutu Lagoon, and the Awatea Stream. Water came through first of all about midnight. This was in May 27th, World War I, and about midnight it came through as had been predicted and worried about at the Fitzroy Bend. Found its way down the old watercourses and then a few hours later broke through also down here further and came into Albert Street, Paiatua Street, Manawatū Street. And as you can see, the flood water went up as far as Ferguson Street in some areas. But you can also see that there were some islands. Those clear patches are islands where the flood water didn't go. Now, this was World War I, and Oh, thank you very much, it was. You know, there's something, I've got a mental block about that, because when I wrote this out the first time, I wrote World War One down and had to correct myself, and thank you very much, Gordon.
You had to put 1914, my mistake. Instead of
41. I might have, but I didn't. Thank goodness. So there we are, middle of the war. And you've got this situation where the water is rising very fast in various parts of Hokafitu. You then had the territorials called out, the police called out, the council staff called out, and they were rescuing people from their houses, from their rooftops, from a telegraph pole. Three council workers got stranded up a telegraph pole. They went down somewhere around here to where the council stables were of that time. And there are two different stories, and they might both be true. But one story is they went to rescue horses, and another story is that they went to rescue a family. Now, they may have gone to get the horses to go to get the family, I'm not sure. One had the newspaper account, one was from the city archives account, so you take your pick. But anyway, they were absolutely stranded. It was a bit unfortunate for the poor horse. And at that stage, telegraph poles had a sort of little platform on it, and one or two of them managed to hang on to the platform, and I'm not quite sure what the third person did, but I understand they were all pretty wet and uncomfortable by the time they were rescued in the early hours of the morning. The Home Guard was called out to help secure the streets the next day. And I was sort of fascinated the picture that newspapers gave about the way the community divided into three groups of people. Those who suffered, those who helped, and you had the Women's War Service Auxiliary out there with their canteen providing food and hot drinks. You had them together with the St. David's Guild and the Red Cross and I think one or two other women's groups turning out with 30 women in the next few days to help spring clean the houses that had been affected. You had council trucks taking off the bedding, the sort of heavier clothing, down to the box factory kiln to get them dried. None of this business of skips out on the street and you toss all your ruined bits in. You had to actually resuscitate the things that were in your home because there wasn't much else at that time. Now, it was very interesting. There were 62 homes only that were inundated in all of that area of Hokafitu, because it was orchards, it was farms, it was market gardens. Some of them were devastated. 300 laying pullets drowned. A heap of pigs that had to be evacuated. The whole harvest of apples that had been picked but not transported away were transported away very effectively by the river. There were cabbages and other vegetables that were sort of lining the puddles. This was 1941. So anyway, meant that the Manawatu Catchment Board understood very well what one of its early tasks was, and that was to really get to work on stop banks. And by 1953, the stop banks were much more effective. There had been some that the River Board had done prior to 1941, but not very effectively. 1953, which in fact was a much larger flood, than the 1941 flood. 1953 flood, middle of summer this time, only came into those areas where you see the narrow hatching. Came through down here particularly, but it also came through, as in 1941, at Rokawa Road, at Te Matai, and of course the Tainui Basin. And one reason I get pretty excited about the thought of anyone building in the Te Matai area is the 2,000-acre lake that was in the Te Matai area on both those occasions. lovely stories of water up to the gasworks drain in 1953 and bits of timber and bits of coke sort of bobbing over the road and into the paddocks. It is not a reassuring picture. Right, so that was 1953, and of course that is the last time the Manawatu has really invaded the city. It's not to say that the Kawau and the Mungoni and the Pioneer Drain haven't done their work subsequently. But that was 1953 when there were big debates going on about Paul Evans' Lower Manawatu Flood Control Scheme, the LMS for short. Now, it was interesting because Paul Evans had brought his scheme to the catchment board in 1950, but you always have this question of who pays for something like stop banks, Motoa floodgates, spillways, rock linings, and other sorts of flood protection. And the system was that people were classified according to benefit and paid according to benefit. And there were 160 challenges to the classification, went to court, and the magistrate, Mr. Grant, threw out the classification, upheld the objections, and this caused a bit of consternation in government circles as well, because remember, Manawatu Catchment Board was very early on the scene. If they were going to suffer this kind of challenge, goodness knows what would happen to the other catchment boards that tried to bring in their schemes. So the government actually brought in legislation that said a magistrate had to either approve a scheme or modify it. Well, they took the scheme back to Magistrate Mr. Grant, and he threw it out again, said it was a nullity, didn't believe in it. However, by the time it went to the Supreme Court and the Appeal Court, the Appeal Court finally gave it the go-ahead, and the Lower Manawatu scheme, as we know it today, started. So I think it was finished, most part was finished by about 63, and the last little bits and pieces were finished about 1968. If you can ever say that a flood protection scheme like that actually is finished, because of course you know we have paid a lot of money for upgrading the scheme since then. Can I just say one thing that probably you all know, but a lot of people don't? The Motoa floodgates do not save the city when they are opened to let water out over the flood plain. They help save some farmland. What saves the city is the stop banks and the rock lining, and come the 1990s, the diversion of the river at the Fitzroy Bend. Interesting that all through the history of European settlement in Palmerston North, there has been that worry about the Fitzroy Bend. And at the cost of $3.4 million in the 1990s, the river was diverted away from the Fitzroy Bend. Now, I see Lucy. You won't mind if I quote you, Lucy, will you? Because it's very appropriate at the moment. I was talking to Lucy Marsden about my thesis 2 or 3 years back now, and Lucy said, I have never trusted that river, and I never will. And I think she is right. We may realign the river, we may do the stop banks, but the river has got its own powers and its own way of saying, hey folks, this is the way it's going to be, at least for a while. So, that's the river and some floods, but that's not the only thing about the river. I want to also tell you about how people... Before I leave the floods, I've got to tell you about... I talked about those who suffer, I talked about those who helped, and people like the Boy Scouts who helped evacuate the transit camp in the 1953 floods. So much water down in the transit camp area down here that army pontoons, timber truck, and the local boating club had to go to the rescue. And tell you a little bit more about the local boating club in a minute or two. Fascinating story. There was the third group of people, though, that I didn't mention before, and I strongly suspect that each one of us at some time has been in that third group of people, those who are just awe-inspired by the spectacle, who go down to the bridge, who go down to the stop banks. I'd have to say that a lot of the newspaper reports of 41 and 53 talk about the chaos on the roads as the cars sort of got in the road of the salvage trucks. And it also talks about the children having a wonderful time riding their bicycles through all the puddles, playing in the gutters, and a wonderful, wonderful sightseeing opportunity on a sunny Sunday afternoon, which was the day after the floods of 1953. It was a January flood, and the sun was shining the next day, and people were out in force. And I would have to say, 1992 and 2004, I was certainly down on the stop banks watching that water and doing a little, you know, crossing the fingers and touching wood and all that sort of thing. So, the enjoyment of the river in flood time, though, brings me to the next thing I want to talk about. And that is the enjoyment of the river when it was being the sort of river that it invites itself to be enjoyed. Now, the recreation on the river has been hidden for quite a lot of its history. The way the city has grown, it's only been fairly recently that people have actually been over to overlook the river from their homes. So I'm not sure that we always are aware that there was a canoe club as early as 1922. The canoe club in 1954 were in the gorge displaying their skills as the train carrying the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh went through the gorge. I mean, I just think that's fantastic. The boat club, don't know when it started, but it was certainly there in 53. It was also there, and come up and have a look at these photos later. It is the photo of the Palmerston North, or a series of photos, the Palmerston North to Foxton Beach boat race on Boxing Day and the 27th of December 1947. And I had a call when I had written to the Tribune to about my thesis, a call from Miss Nolene Olson, whom some of you may know, and she said to me, you know, might be interested in some of these photos. Well, I just thought this was wonderful. Do come and have a look at it later on. At the same time, come and have a look at the punt that took people across the gorge about 1877 there. Just a real treasure, I think, those photos. So there was a lot of actually activity sort of slowly building up, but still, by 1964, the editor of the Manawatu Standard was saying, now that we've got the flood protection in place, we can really get on and enjoy the river. And certainly, there was all the sort of things that we know about, the swimming, the picnics, the boating club, the canoe club, the fishermen. I mean, it's a wonderful river for fish. And just try and get a fisherman, though, to tell you where his or her favourite spot is, and you're really, really dabbling in dangerous waters there. But, you know, the fishing licences issued for the Manawatu River, not just this part, but the whole length of the Manawatu River, very, very significant. You had the acclimatisation societies, making sure that the fish stayed in the river and that people didn't shoot game fowl at the wrong time of the year. You had the forest and bird people, the ornithological people down by the estuary. And further downstream from here, you had the powerboat club, the sailing club, the water skiing fraternity, the white baiters. They had a bit of aggro at times when some of the clubs and the catchment board didn't get along superbly well. So in 1973, and I also have to say you had the Marine Department, the Marine Division of the Department of Labour was also involved because they set the speed restrictions on the river. And the speed restriction was 5 knots. They had areas where people could water ski and the powerboats could be. But about 1963 or 4, I've forgotten which, there was a convoy of 10 jet boats that came up from Foxton to Albert Street. And I want to read you what the reporter at the time said about that, if I can actually find it. I've left the script behind ages ago. Here we go. The reporter talked about being intoxicated with the sense of speed, the wind blowing through your hair and plucking at your clothes. Now, jet boats became increasingly popular, but they did not always get along well with those quieter, more tranquil users of the river. Now, the Manawatu River Users Association had been set up in 1973 by the catchment board when things started to go a bit sour between them and some of the river users. And it was this group that the Jet Boat Association also became involved with. And that's where a lot of the issues were sorted out. The jet boaters over a number of years, or decades actually, tried to push the boundaries. They wanted the speed restrictions lifted. And they were lifted in certain parts of the river, but not in the stretch from Ashurst down to about Te Aki Tahuna Road. It varied a bit at times, but there was that sort of city stretch where they said, no, that's for those who do not sort of really appreciate having a jet boat roar past them when they're in the middle of their swimming or their fishing or their canoeing or whatever, or their bird watching. So there was quite a lot, over 20 plus years, you kept having the jet boaters pushing the boundaries. I'd have to say they were indomitable. They took setback after setback and came back for more. They're still around and they still use the river on certain occasions, and my understanding is that they are actually in the middle of applying at the moment to have the speed restrictions lifted over the winter months. And that's probably okay. But anyway, what happened was the catchment board and the river users group had a few problems over all this. And there were actually two occasions, 1976 and 1979, when the catchment board called for public submissions about just this use of the river and what was its sort of appropriate recreational use. I'd have to say that very few individuals made submissions at that time, but all the groups involved certainly did. Bit of hostility at times. There were threats reported in the newspaper. Some of you may remember that at one stage there were sort of somebody threatening to put barbed wire across the river, you know, as the jet boats went through. Now, whether that was an actual threat or a sort of hoax threat or what, I'm not sure, but it did mean that the catchment board, you know, took some action over this, and that things did settle down. And then in 1986, somebody came along and said, there's money to be made here. We can attract tourists, excuse me. We could have a lovely jet boat tour between Fitzherbert Bridge and Ashurst. And seemed a good idea to some, but not such a good idea to others. And there was another round of public submissions. And the reason I mention it is that one or two private individuals did make submissions there, and I want to read one of those. And some of you will certainly remember Peter Apthorpe, who was town clerk here for quite a while. Peter was a keen canoeist, and he's writing as a river user, not as a town clerk. And this is what he wrote in 1986, and I think it's a lovely picture of the river. On a fine summer evening, it is not unusual for there to be three or four fishermen at every pool at the foot of every rapid. I have occasionally seen windsurfers in small sailing boats. There are increasing numbers of citizens who use the river and the walkway for walking, jogging, picnics, and all the other passive uses that this presently tranquil stretch of the river attracts. Now, I would have to say, for a number of years I argued with Peter and others about the use of passive activity for things like picnics and swimming and so on. However, you get the message from that. Peter didn't mention another very popular and not so tranquil use of the river, and that was the raft races. That the raft races that started at least in the 1950s and went through at least into the early 1990s. And some years there were up to a dozen or so raft races. Social groups, Massey, the Scouts, the radio stations, some church youth groups. Really, this was one of the ways that the river was really, really enjoyed. I got some reports about a great deal of spectator participation, the sort of participation about throwing tomatoes at the people on the rafts and the people on the rafts sort of squirting jets of water back. On one occasion, and this I think was early 1990s, there was a little bit of excitement when Manawatu Ashfelts hurled some tar-based missiles at spectators and faced a reasonable sort of dry cleaning bill afterwards, which they accepted, I understand. So you had all these sort of things happening on the river, but Peter made mention of one other feature that I want to talk about. He talked about the walkway. By 1986, the walkway was pretty well established, but it had taken over 20 years at that time since the Pony Club had decided the roads were getting too busy, there were houses growing over too many of the sort of open parts of the city, and they needed somewhere safe for something like 500 members of the Pony Club to take their ponies. And so they said, can we have a bridle path? And the city council, as city councils are wont to do, said yes, as long as it doesn't cost us anything. However, I'd have to say, in fairness to the city council, over the years it did cost quite a lot. It cost quite a lot of time, quite a lot of effort, and I want to pay my respects to two particularly indomitable women, Pauline Keyes and Kitty Seifert, who actually were absolute driving forces behind getting the bridle path underway. Now look, it was a wilderness down by the river. I mean, there were ditches, there were logs, there were brambles, there was just every sort of, and rubbish, every sort of bit of debris you can imagine that had to be cut through, bulldozed through. It was hard work. However, I have to say for Pauline Keyes and Kitty Seifert, they also had a great ability to just wind themselves around the fingers of directors of parks and reserves and certain councillors who had great interest in parks and reserves as well. And so, but it took a long time. And, you know, I mentioned that on the river, you had this conflict, you know, with the technology of jet boats going fast and the sort of more tranquil users of the river. Same thing happened on the walkway. You got the riders, the horse riders, you got the walkers, because not long after this, you got the Heart Foundation starting to promote walkways societies, and sort of all sorts of things were happening in that health scene. You got the jogging movement. But you also got the motorcyclists. They've sort of faded out a bit, I think, because probably the ones who were the motorcyclists of those days are the boy racers of today. That's my theory, anyway. But you had complaints about the pugnacious behaviour of the motorcyclists on the walkway bridle path. You had complaints from people in parks and reserves. Not only did they ignore the notices and the barriers, but they pulled them out and threw them in the river as well. So, you know, you had contested space on the river, you had contested space on the walkway as well. But slowly, slowly the walkway was developed, and as I said, by 1986 it was very well developed. But there was a group who sort of missed out a little bit with the wilderness changing to civilization along the side of the river. It did. The walkway bridle path has introduced hundreds of people to the river, people for whom probably the river never meant anything except when it was in flood. But it had been a great adventure ground for children. And you head down the west end, you had the River Kids. And Jack Register was a River Kid. And I want to read something that Jack said. Had a lovely interview with him when I was doing the thesis. We used to love it when there was a slight fresh coming. And Jack's talking about growing up in the 40s and the 50s. Because you could whip across, and there was a good current, and we'd get out and sit on the logs. Now I think about it, it was quite dangerous. But remember, we were River Kids. And Merv Hancock, when I was talking to him, made an interesting observation about how the folk up at Terrace End, where he swam in the baths, knew that down there, down the west end, that was the River Kids' territory. Knew about it, knew the river, knew the esplanade, but the young people were territorial as well. But there were other River Kids down the Albert Street end of things. People for whom the river was part of their daily lives. And people for whom the wilderness was part of the fun of it. And Doug Strachan spoke to me. He was growing up a bit later, about in the 70s and 80s, about the bridle path down the Ruamahunga end of things, down by the golf course, being just a very narrow, muddy track winding through then. And all the vegetation that made a wonderful spot for playing Tarzan. There was also Higgins Yard near Roxburgh Crescent, and they had great illicit fun in Higgins Yard as well, and little debates with the police at times about that, I understand. But the river had always been a source of attraction for the children. Tony Rasmussen speaks about the river being part of his young life as well. And you can correct me if I get this wrong, Tony, because I see you down there. Tony talked about the river down at the Albert Street end being a sort of rough and ready playground in his youth. And as a five-year-old on his first day at school, following the big kids down to the river after school. And people had been doing that for a long time. Nancy Smith, in her book about the Perrin family, talks about son Perrin in the end of the 19th century getting canings very frequently for wandering down to the river with the other kids after school and being late home. There were youngsters, boys around 1900, who would go down to the river to hear the hermit, Peter Gray, talk about his stories, and they'd swim in forbidden pools in the river. Parents have always been worried about the dangers of the river. Saw that as recently as the submissions to the Esplanade proposal 1 year ago in the draft annual plan, when there was the proposal about that sort of diving platform and viewing platform and so on at the Esplanade, a number of submissions wrote about the dangers of the river. So there we had that sort of wilderness aspect of the river disappearing. It does mean that a lot more people use it now, but maybe something's lost as well. The river was a sad place for some people. There certainly were drownings, there certainly were accidental drownings, there were suicides. It has been a place of sadness. It has been a place to be concerned about, but it's also a grand place. I mentioned Peter Gray, the hermit, about 1900, living down by the river. Don't know anything else about him, other than that he obviously was a good storyteller. But other people have lived by the river as well, and I know of three. There was Carl. Now, Carl was... See, now I've got a tear duct that isn't doing its sort of right job with my right eye. There was Carl. He lived under the Fitzherbert Bridge. This is sometime in the 1980s. Only there a month. Said he was wanting an alternative lifestyle. Had his dog, I think. Whiskey, I think, was his dog. Then there was Jim. Jim, who lived in a tent down Te Matai for about 4 years, became quite well known to the folk down there, very reticent about himself, but very up with current affairs and a knowledgeable man, living on a sickness benefit apparently, and he died just aged 57 in 1995. Just the river gave him some sort of sense of a place for him. And then, of course, there was Danny. Now, I don't know if Danny is still near the river, but Danny was there in 2006, living in a tarpaulin sort of shelter. And Danny became well known to some of his neighbours and certainly seen by people using the riverbank. And then, of course, as sometimes happens, and this is post my thesis, April the 5th, 2007, vandals set fire to Hobo's shelter. Now, I thought, why? Why do people have to do things like that? Now, however, anyone can read this later if they wish. People actually did help Danny out. I don't know if Danny's his real name or not, if that's what the paper called him. But, you know, that's a person for whom the river was literally his doorstep as well. And other people have found interesting resources along the river. Now, I'm not going to go into the fantastic gravel resource that the river is and has been. That's quite a story in itself. But that was a sort of exploitive use of the river. Useful when it comes to sort of keeping the level of the river where you want it to be, but exploitive. And the other exploitive use, of course, has been the discharge of waste water into the river. And I want to talk about that. It was 1900 when the first earthenware pipes started a sewerage system in Palmerston North. And the pipes took water down to the... it was 1890. It wasn't 1900, it was 1890. Took the wastewater down to an area just below the Esplanade, and for a number of years, untreated sewage was discharged into the river. 1900, it was not the letters from the mayor of Foxton and the chairman of the Horowhenua County that made the city do something about the water. It was the Department of Public Health in 1900 that said, you have to treat this water, Palmerston North. We have a bubonic plague scare. And so treatment then started, a lineup of septic tanks and things like that, sort of alongside the river before it was discharged, partially treated into the river. I'm certainly not going to go into all the stages of treatment that occurred up into wastewater 2006, but sufficient at this moment to say, by 2006, there was a rising consciousness about the importance of the environment, including the environment of our rivers, and the conservation of our flora and fauna and natural heritage, rising up through the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. And I'm going to come back to that, because something very significant happened in 2006 and is carrying on until as of last weekend. That's where I want to finish this talk, though. I've got another bit to tell you in between. The bridges of this city. Long story, more story than bridges, but never mind. I want to go to 1971, when there was a proposal, and at this stage, it wasn't just the City Council deciding where a bridge would be. The Ministry of Works were the planners, and the National Roads Board and the District Roads Board, number 9A, were the funders. So you didn't just have council decisions. And there was a lot of disturbance around the city when, in late 70, early 1971, the proposal came out of a duplicate bridge at the Fitzherbert Bridge. You know, there was the old arched bridge, the 1935 bridge there at the time. There was a suggestion that that would be a two-lane bridge going out, and there would be a three-lane new bridge beside it, bringing traffic in. Fitzherbert Avenue would be widened. And just by the way, 9 perches of the Esplanade would go. Now, this really put the cat among the pigeons, so to speak. And became an election campaign. So on the one hand, you had councillors like Joyce Dunmore saying, it's got to be Cook Street. You had other councillors saying, well, we could go upstream, but the people of Hokafeto had sort of rejected that a few years earlier, so maybe not. It was a real storm. And people like Councillor Gordon Brown were saying, this is a mini Manapouri. This is, you know, a conservationist issue. You know, it was that conservation movement, our environment was increasing in our consciousness. I'm almost finished. The Citizens Initiative Group also arose at this time, an activist group. Massey University had a strong role to play in the Citizens Initiative, but not the total role. But you had a group of articulate, energetic, determined people who wanted the bridge to go down at Cook or Botanical Road. The result actually was an impasse. And about 1973, the council finally came round to saying, well, okay, we will look further downstream, we'll keep the duplicate in mind as well. The National Roads Board, the District Roads Board said, well, maybe we'll have a four-lane bridge where the present one is. But the National Roads Board said, sorry, run out of money. We'll give you a two-lane one sometime. In the meantime, of course, there was the Bulls Bridge collapse in 1973, and safety concerns sort of hit most bridges around the country. So the Roads Board were talking about sort of piling a heap of rocks and things around the piles of the old bridge to actually prevent scouring. Then 1981, Alan Bickers and the Ministry of Works came up with a report that talked about the social catastrophe if actually those bridge piles were scoured out, rocks and so on notwithstanding. So they finally got an agreement that a new bridge would be built. It took 7 years, but it came. And of course, it wasn't a four-lane. There just wasn't the money. There was a sort of fairly generous two-lane with cycle lanes. Another protest group arose, the students, because they said, okay, the bridge might be structurally safe, but it's not safe for cyclists because there's nothing separating the cycles from the cars. And the day the new bridge was opened, there was a gala held on the bridge, and the students held their protest. They had a best-dressed bikes and corpses competition, judged by one MP, Trevor Declean, and I suspect Trevor enjoyed himself hugely on that day. So that was 1987. The council, though, was saying, this is not good enough. We know we can widen this to three lanes, but we are still faced with the issue of the avenue. Time went by into the 1990s. The council got busy, the road out to Massey was widened, the flyover went ahead, some replanting was done of trees in Fitzherbert Avenue between Ferguson and College Street. But then there was talk about the rest of the trees going, because the bridge was four-laned, cycle bits were put on, and pedestrian bits. And the council were determined to get rid of the remaining trees in the avenue to get them shifted further out. You get your second activist group rising, the Save the Avenue campaign. I'm not going to talk about that because you all know about the Save the Avenue campaign. Bruce and I learnt about it when we were in London in January 1997, and there was... The English were out here playing cricket, and for some reason we picked up a Times newspaper, and there was a photograph in the Times taken from inside Fitzherbert Park looking across at the cricket ground, and my husband, who is a lot more observant than I am, immediately said, the trees have gone. You could see the Phoenix Palms, but the other trees had gone. So that's enough of that story. But I wanted to mention those two activist groups, Citizens Initiative and Save the Avenue, because the third and activist group rose in 2006, and it really was catalysed. I mean, it goes back over 100 years, the roots of this. It goes back to things like the Mayor of Foxton writing to the Borough Council here about city's wastewater. But the catalyst in 2006 was the Fonterra, or the Horizons Regional Council, giving the discharge consent to Fonterra. And that brought people together in a protest movement. There was the march through the city, there were submissions made. Those of you who lived out at Akautri might have seen the sign. There was a sign out there advertising the Vaucluse subdivision, and stamped across that great big stenciled Save Our River. The first time it had been claimed as our river. And this, to me, was really exciting. It was wonderful. The fact that it was people right down the length of the river and beyond. It wasn't just local people, but it was local people and scientists and people from Marae, people from Foxton, people from Waitariri, people from Rokawa down at Otaki. I just thought it was fantastic that people were claiming the river as ours. Not the river, but our river. And as I said, that story went on to last weekend. I don't know how many of you went or saw in the Tribune the Forest and Bird Race for Our River that they were sponsoring a triathlon sort of event, fun event, last weekend. Right, so you've got that sense of the river being ours and part of the city. And I just want to finish by bringing together three things that a very wise person in Palmerston North said to me. This environmental consciousness conservation movement that has happened, the walkway that has introduced people to the river, the growth across the river, so that now there are hundreds of people every day who live across the river and work in town, just as there are people who live in town and work across the river at Massey and the science centres. People who see the river because they cross it every day. You are getting a sense of the river being not on the edge of the city as it was until 1989, but really becoming much more central in the city. And I want to finish with quoting the words of that wise man, somewhere down here. We are in the midst of a change in attitude where the river is becoming central to the city, and there are forces that may move it towards becoming pristine. That wise man was Merv Hancock, and I want to leave it with his words. Thank you all very much.